15 суток ареста грозит Алексею Навальному.
Пресечение в отношении Алексея Навального на домашний арест.
На Манежной площади и Тверской улице.
Десятки людей уже отправлены.
Алексею Навальному дали 7, а Борису Немцову или Яшину по 10.
Владимир Путин распорядился провести внезапную проверку боеготовности войск
с частями Северного и Балтийского флотов.
В соответствии с распоряжением президента Российской Федерации.
The message to Russia's opposition was crystal clear. It ain't happening here. In what looked like an attempt to inoculate Russia against the revolutionary virus spreading from Ukraine, police in Moscow this week detained hundreds of demonstrators who were attempting to protest the censuses handed down in the Bolotnaya case. Among those rounded up were opposition figures Alexei Navalny, Boris Nemtsov, Ilya Yashin, as well as Pussy Riot members Nadezhda Telikonikova and Maria Alokhina. Additionally, some guy, perhaps a bystander, was also detained for wearing a hat with Ukraine's blue and yellow colors. "So you support Kyiv," police reportedly said to him. "Come with us." And later in the week, a Moscow court placed Navalny under house arrest, confining him to his home and barring him from using the internet. Meanwhile, with the new pro-Western Ukrainian government consolidating its power in Kyiv, the Kremlin sent another message to its southern neighbor. "We have plenty of tools at our disposal to make your lives miserable. Pro-Moscow gunmen seized government buildings and airports in Crimea. Russia launched surprise military exercises near the Ukrainian border and granted protection to ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. And the State Duma took up a bill that would make it easier for territories in other countries to join the Russian Federation." So it's a two-front war for the Kremlin. The objectives: stop the contagion at home and reverse a stinging geopolitical loss abroad. Hello from our studios in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Hello.
Let's start with the battle at home, stopping the contagion. We'll get to the battle abroad in a bit. As I blogged this week, the specter of Ukraine is very much in the air in Russia. This was evident in the Moscow demonstrators chanting Maidan and, remarkably, in Ukrainian, Banduhit, or out with the gang. And in the performance artist Pyotr Pavlensky, his burning tire action called Freedom in St. Petersburg that mimicked the action of the Maidan protesters. It was also evident in Boris Nemtsov's lengthy Facebook post arguing that Russia's Maidan was inevitable. And of course, it was evident in Navalny's house arrest, which happened just hours before I came into the studio, and in the roundup of more than 400 people in Moscow earlier in the week. Something like this, a crackdown at home, of course, was predictable. Mark, I think you probably predicted it on the podcast a couple weeks ago. I think we all did. How do you see all this playing out? What wins, an emboldened street or the strong hand of the state, or the stronger hand of the state, if you will?
Well, at the moment, I suggest that everyone is playing their roles in the dramaturgy that is Russian politics. You know, the state is expected to be bloody-minded and bloody-handed. They obliged. The street in Moscow, you know, is expected to kick up a fuss, get arrested, fill a few aftersaki, and so forth. They obliged. The big question is the okay, now what? I mean, it's quite interesting that they are giving, on a sort of small scale, Navalny the Udaltsov treatment.
Right, that surprised me a bit. I didn't think that was coming.
Well, no, but I mean, I think it's a clever move in that precisely because actually depriving him of the oxygen of publicity, is probably the most effective thing to do
with
him.
Is there any more effective way to punish Alexei Navalny than taking away his internet privileges? I don't think so.
quite exactly. He'll be sort of tapping away on the walls of his apartment as a sort of substitute for tweeting. But I think this is the point. I think at the moment, really, there's been this sort of single round, and I agree that I think in some ways, the interesting thing are just some of the nuances rather than the big picture. The big picture is exactly what we expected, I would suggest. But the nuances, for example, just quite how heavily the authorities cracked down. It's quite interesting, when I went along to the morning protest at the Zamoskvoretsiye court, and at that point it was early, there still weren't vast numbers, though obviously more and more people were arriving, but very much it was largely of middle-aged people. These did not look like kind of, stormtroopers of the Maidan in waiting. But nonetheless, at that point, they were massively outnumbered by the security forces that were there. And again, the security forces, yes, they were police. But, there was a lot of interior troops. And indeed, there were interior troop special forces there. This was definitely more than just the usual kind of thing.
But people were chanting Maidan, Maidan, and calling the riot police Berkut.
Bless them. But I think, again, this is what I mean about the sort of dramaturgy. It takes more than just simply appropriating for the moment some of the phrases to actually mean it. If one looks at the extraordinary way that Maidan played out, and okay, it radicalized over time, but even from the beginning, for reasons that, we can talk later, were different. Maidan was a very, very different kind of event. This was not just people turning up wearing badges and chanting. This was people who went out there starting to, crack skulls and burn tires, not as performance art, but as basically part of a street revolution.
Yeah, and as I wrote in the blog this week, one of the reasons they succeeded is because they were willing to stay out there till the bitter end. They didn't seek any sanction to have a protest or not. They didn't disperse when the police even started using live ammunition. In fact,
the opposite. They ran into it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that says it all. And okay, arguably they wouldn't have done that if it had been week one of Maidan. There was a process of radicalization, of esprit de corps and so forth. But the point is exactly by week whatever, they were perfectly willing to do that. And that's what eventually broke through, I would say.
Sean, what do you think? Did Ukraine change the game at all in Russia? Your thoughts on this and what we were talking about as well. But bringing in, do you think Ukraine changed this, or is this just your typical Russian set piece continuing on?
In the case of the regime's heavy response, I think that's certainly – they're not going to allow any inkling of a repeat of Ukraine. So they're going to come down hard even to small protests and arrest as many people as they can arrest for whatever reasons, even for the reason that you gave for wearing a hat that has Ukrainian colors.
But accidentally, it had a New York insignia on it, but it just happened to have. Yeah.
there you go. Right. This is the mentality. Symbolizes the mentality that they're just not going to allow it. But I think what Mark opened with is right. There's a certain dramaturgical aspect to this, where you protest and we arrest you, though with a different level of intensity because Ukraine is on people's minds, but. In terms of the Ukrainian infection, at least for the opposition movement, I don't see really any signs of it outside of any kind of hope or aspirations, because what issue is going to bring people out and then stay there? I think this is the key thing that you pointed out, that in Ukraine, they didn't move. And then when the police came in on November 30th and beat up a bunch of students, more people came out. So the question is, what is going to first bring people out in Russia, and what's going to make them stay? That could be a reaction to the police, but the Russian opposition movement, and we've said this many, many times before, doesn't seem to have the level of organization or even will to do something as we saw in Kyiv.
Yeah, nor did the Ukrainian opposition movement before this, though. If you remember, the proximate cause of this was Yanukovych not signing a association agreement with the European Union.
Yeah, but when I, now reflecting back when I was in Kyiv in the summer, I was told by people that this was going to be a big deal.
Yeah, no, it was. We were prepared for it to be a big deal, too. But if you step back and think that's an interesting proximate cause. Now, the underlying cause was deep dissatisfaction with this regime and with the corruption and fears of loss of sovereignty.
Right.
But it just so happened to boil up at that point. Go ahead.
I think also, too, that the fact that Ukraine has that experience of actually coming out in the streets and changing the political wind, at least, you know, in 2004, changing it to overturn a fraudulent election. I mean, that's a really big deal. It gives a lot of power to people in the street and people's minds. So I just don't see anything replicated similarly in Russia.
Right. Well, let's pick up on that because, like, again, as I blogged this week, the Russian street has shown nothing like neither the stamina nor the persistence of its Ukrainian counterpart. And it probably isn't going to change anything until it does show something more closely approximating that. Why not? And can it? Either or, whoever wants to jump in.
Tung, let me open by saying, Tung admittedly rather firmly in cheek that Navalny's problem is he doesn't have enough neo-Nazi friends. In the sense, actually, if you look at when revolutions, and this was a revolution, succeed, there is usually some kind of a vanguard. Now, you know, again, we're talking slightly Leninist terms here. And that vanguard, Workuril here, he'd be talking about these sort of, you know, they're professional full-time revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they are or they aren't. But the point is, in some ways, the problem with the Russian street at the moment is that it is, okay, sometimes sentimental, sometimes self-indulgent. But nonetheless, in almost its limitation is that it's quite rational. It doesn't, on the whole, want to tear down the system. It doesn't want to see Moscow burn. It doesn't want to sort of actually take on the Amon and the FSB and everyone else and just send them reeling with Molotovs and brickbats and such like. In some ways, what we've got are the sort of the competent political technocrats, exactly the kind of people who are good at picking up the pieces after the violent vanguard has done the shattering. But at the moment, anyway, what actually breaks the will and the unity and the will to rule of the state apparatus? That's what hasn't emerged. Now, there's all kinds of ways you can do it. You don't have to do it by street violence. I mean, emphasize before comments start rolling in. That was tongue-in-cheek. But nonetheless, you have to have something that is going to break through. Now, sometimes it's precisely that you can build a genuine national movement so that actually you can break through either through democratic politics or by forcing the regime to rig the election so obviously and badly that it backfires on them. Again, you know, mm-hmm. thinking of the Ukraine. Maybe it's because you managed to genuinely break the unity of the elite. Again, thinking of mm-hmm. Ukraine. Or maybe it's precisely that you actually managed to basically make your capital city ungovernable. But there has to be
which
something.
Which is what happened in Ukraine.
Exactly.
Well, picking up on what you said, there were two times when I thought the streets could really get out of control. And both of them are affiliated with Mr. Navalny. We all recall the night last summer after his verdict came down in the Kirov-Lesk case and what we saw, the remarkable things we saw in the streets of Moscow and the remarkable capitulation of the regime the next day and Navalny's remarkable return to Moscow on that train the next morning. And the second time was at the after the Moscow elections, When he stood there and said, "I'm not going to ask you to burn tires and light torches today, but I might someday, and I'll be with you." Those are the two times where I thought, this could get interesting. And now, interestingly enough, Mr. Navalny's under house arrest. The other person possibly capable of putting, you know, people on the streets that could break this regime is Udaltsov, and he is also under house arrest. Do you think there's any logic to this?
I don't know if there's really. I don't know about logic. Well, I'll answer that question next. What I wanted to say is that what in those two instances that you brought up, the Russian government didn't do was crack down, which is exactly what the Ukrainian government did that further increased the level of resistance. They pulled back. They let that unsanctioned demonstration go on. They didn't start arresting people. They didn't come in with clubs. They just kind of let it go and let the steam come out of it. So I think in both of those cases, you didn't have the overwhelming police presence, which would have allowed this to get out of hand. Mm. The second thing I wanted to say is back to your question of why Russia isn't Ukraine. I mean, we of course could talk about a lot of reasons why.
Or why the Russian street doesn't have stamina.
Why the Russian street? Yeah. Why does the Russian street have stamina? Well, they don't. Again, back to the issue. They don't have the issue to really galvanize them. I mean, one of the things about what happened in Ukraine is that the economy is in really bad shape. There is enough disgruntled people with Yanukovych that binded them together and kept them out on the street. And for all we want to talk about the Russian opposition, they're a very small force, and there's just not enough dissatisfaction in Russian society with Putin at this point to really galvanize enough people to have a mass demonstration.
Yeah, no, Putin's numbers are growing now.
Yeah,
which,
exactly. I saw 67%.
Yeah, that's the last number I saw. Some I take with a grain of salt, but Levada's got him in the 60s.
Yeah,
you know, that's when I take notice.
It's quite high. I mean, he's bounced back thanks to the Olympics from kind of, people were talking about how he was tanking gradually.
Yeah.
So there really isn't – Russia is not in the same kind of social economic situation and or political situation that Ukraine is. Russia doesn't have an opposition that's in parliament that can act as that kind of side of the protest where, in the halls of power, working in the Duma, et cetera.
Right.
In terms of if the logic of putting Udaltsov and Navalny, perhaps this is part of some kind of, at this moment, putting Navalny under house arrest, I think you can certainly connect that to events in Ukraine. Absolutely.
Yeah, I certainly think that's because that was unexpected. I saw that there were calls for it. I didn't think they were going to do it. And I was frankly surprised when I saw that come over the wire this morning.
What will be interesting is if they extend it.
Yeah, because it's until April, mm-hmm. and it's in this Ivrashe case that his brother supposedly charged more than they paid for something they were selling. Because maybe if you look at every Navalny case, it's basically Putin's criminalized capitalism. I guess it's amazing. Now, the regime's obviously opted for a crackdown, and one has to wonder, given that Putin's numbers are rising, isn't this something – and given that the economy, it has had so for a long time, but it appears to have storm clouds on the horizon. I got to get an economist on this podcast to talk about this soon. but could this be a mistake cracking down? Mark, what do you think?
Oh, you know me. It's never a mistake, in my opinion, to crack down. I think – it's not a mistake if it's part of a complex of measures. If they think that just cracking down and dealing with say, Navalny and throwing some well-meaning liberals into prison for a day or two is going to fix things, then clearly they're deluding themselves. The interesting thing is that in some ways one could actually say that Navalny is in many ways the Kremlin's best friend. I mean, you consider those two potential flashpoints that you mentioned before. In both cases, actually, Navalny chose not to push. Basically, he was convicted in this ridiculous case, and then they decide, it's not like we're going to actually overturn the conviction. We're going to say yes, you can still play, and basically legitimize Sobyanin.
Right.
And he went and duly played.
Okay,
and there's no point then afterwards saying, after you won what was, yes, an unexpectedly high proportion, but nonetheless, a minority of the votes, there's no point then saying, hey, actually, this is all illegitimate. Mm-hmm. And likewise, he had that great head of steam, and he simply said, well, someday I might well be calling on you. Well, I can guarantee you that there's not going to be that head of steam. It's not just sitting there waiting, ready to be sort of turned on again.
No, heads of steam need to be built up.
So, in that respect, Navalny is not a revolutionary. He is a reformer, maybe even a radical reformer. But essentially he wants to change the existing system. And in that respect, it's quite useful. The point is that you might say this crackdown, it's dealing with symptom rather than cause. Now, sure, all the various big underlying pressures within Russian society are not ones that lend themselves easily and quickly to mass protest. No one is going to go out on the streets because there's not enough being spent on infrastructure. But then again, who would have thought people would go out on the streets for the European Union? I mean, what happens is actually that things emerge often as metaphors, shall we say, for mm-hmm. all the other big things that are around. And yeah, at the moment there isn't anything obvious,
right?
But something in due course will emerge.
The Duma 2011 Duma election emerged as a proximate cause for a lot of underlying discontent. Mm-hmm. Sean, you look like mm-hmm. you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just want to go against the idea that people came out for the European Union. They came out because the government cracked down and beat up on a bunch of students. This is what the brutality of the Yanukovych government on the first night. This is what brought out, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people.
That's what brought out the mass crowds. Yeah, that's
right. I mean, I think this is an important distinction to make. But I think this goes back to one of the things that goes back to something that Mark has said repeatedly on this podcast, and I think I've said too, is that Navalny is a reactive figure. He's not a proactive one. Mm-hmm. So he reacts to events, and I think both of those cases suggest some kind of reaction, particularly the second case in terms of the mayoral elections. But he's not a proactive one in the sense that he's not going to push. It doesn't seem to be part of his political agenda to really push an event towards a certain direction.
Mm-hmm. One has to wonder. I mean, because if you look at what happened with Udaltsov, I mean, I kind of miss the guy. He's been absent from the media. I mean, I saw an interview that he conducted through his lawyer, surreptitiously written form that Gazeta.ru published the other, and I just pored over the thing. I was so excited; it was like having a piece of Samizdat, right? They basically effectively silenced the man. I mean, they really silenced him. Do you see Navalny getting silenced? Because if I missed Udaltsov, I'm really going to miss Navalny. No,
well, I think they're different figures. I mean, the state could choose to silence Navalny.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just simply a question of what price is it willing to pay. You know, the West was not going to leap up and down saying, you know, how dare you silence a post-Stalinist communist? you know, that basically, right. In the West, no one cares.
Udaltsov's a lot less cuddly, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he didn't have the same sort of support base at home, likewise. Navalny, yes, you know, he has West appeal.
Yeah.
You know, he has people who will agitate and continue to sort of bring his name up or whatever. You know, I can point to sort of where there's a car still around here in Pavelecka which has Navalny stickers on it. I have yet to see anything with Free Udaltsov. Mm-hmm. I think therefore it's like all of these things. You know, regimes can usually do whatever they want if they're willing and able to pay the price tag.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not convinced that in the long term. You know, you think of just simply why they let Khodorkovsky out. I mean, to an extent, it was just simply because after a certain point, the value had a long time back, frankly, the value had been overtaken by the cost.
Mm.
Well, likewise, putting Navalny in this kind of a box, yes, it's fine as a short-term measure, but as a long-term one, you suddenly start to find that, you know, whoever is the new U.S. ambassador takes it up as a cause, et cetera, et cetera. Mm.
Mark, I want to stick with you for a minute, because if we're talking about a crackdown, we got to, you know, take a look at the Siloviki. And I know how much you love talking about the Siloviki. Something that slipped under most people's radar, but I know it didn't slip under yours, was the arrest of Boris Kolesnikov this week, the interior ministry figure who's in charge of combating corruption. As I understand it, he was investigating corruption in the FSB before his arrest. Walk us through this. Wow. Walk us through this. And does it point to some kind of splits among the Siloviki, or what does it point to, if anything?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating case. I won't go through all the ins and outs, or else we'd be basically on our third power vertical by the time I'd finished. I mean, broadly speaking, Kolesnikov stands accused of having tried to frame or rather extort money from an FSB bigwig. And this is actually part of a general bloodletting. We've already seen Alexeyev, deputy interior minister, being mm-hmm. sacked by presidential decree. We've seen Kolesnikov's boss
mm-hmm.
Also being, by different accounts, sacked or allowed to leave. You know, there clearly is definitely sort of blood on the streets outside the MVD office. What this really says, I mean, in a way, regardless of the truth of the matter, and I'll be honest, I think it's quite unlikely. If you're going to predate on someone, actually picking senior FSB officers as your targets, it's probably a pretty bad idea.
Mm.
I don't believe that would be a purely economic activity. Instead, I mean, this goes to what you're indicating. I mean, this is a point where actually we're seeing increasing tensions amongst and within the Siloviki. I mean, in some ways, there has been there was a truce in the lead up to Sochi, because everyone knew that, you know, they had to coordinate in order to ensure that Sochi was safe. This was a big priority that was coming straight down out of the Kremlin. And if anyone looked as if they were doing anything to undermine that, it would be distinctly bad for their future career prospects. So everyone just basically gritted their teeth and did all the thing they had to do. But of course, you know, even before Sochi ended, once it seemed clear that it actually had been a successful security operation, that tension came away. And you have Bastrykin trying to actually basically ease out the Interior Ministry's counterpart investigations division. Mm-hmm. You have the Federal Anti-Drug Service trying to create its own external intelligence service, and in the process stepping on the toes of both the FSB and also the Foreign Intelligence Service. You have the FSB and the Interior Ministry at daggers drawn over who gets to control economic crime, both because that's politically important, because nowadays, you know, in modern Russian politics, that's how you actually deal with your enemies. You allege or prove economic criminality, but also because that's where the money is. You know, it's a real honeypot for corrupt payments. And so what's happening is basically all these tensions, I think, are spilling out. And to me, why that's important is simply in two reasons. One is it undermines the cohesion and power of the state. We saw that last time there was a Silovik war back in 07, that it actually made the Siloviki, they were too busy fighting each other to do much of anything else.
And it's interesting, that was kind of the point of the highest point of Putinism, and it's been downhill ever since.
Exactly. And the point is, then Putin could step in and fix it and crack heads and sack some people and sort it. Now I can't help but feel that one of the reasons why it's coming out is because people aren't afraid so much of Putin, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not Putin really can rein it in.
Now push that a little bit farther, push that into the post-Maidan environment in Russia, the attempts at cracking down. Does that bear on that in any way?
Well, it certainly distracts. I mean, you know, it takes the focus away. And it also means that actually policing the street will become another, or potentially become another one of these contested objects. If there's political power in showing that you're best at policing the streets, then the FSB, the Investigations Committee, the MVD, and different arms of the Interior Ministry, they'll all be competing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the risk is that, firstly, someone might push policy into an over-draconian way, the way we've seen with Bastrykin in the past. Or, alternatively, it means that precisely policy ends up being a muddle.
Are there factions within the Siloviki that think maybe it's not such a good idea to crack down right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been clearly the line we've seen from Kolokoltsev, the interior minister.
So from MVD?
Yeah. But again, the trouble is that MVD is not a power vertical, like every other bit of Russia. In that it's clear that, for example, the anti-extremism division, technically part of MVD, actually is much more closely affiliated with the FSB. So this is it. I mean, this is why it's as much. It's not just nice, straightforward, you know, feudal baronies of Siloviks.
It's battles within
internal as well.
Right.
Well, it's a splendid mix.
Hell of an interesting time to have a Siloviki war, and we'll keep watching that. Before we move on to the next part, I wanted to just touch on something, and I don't have an answer to this. I just like see if we can kind of muse on this. But like, how does contagion really happen? You know, I mean, everybody talks about contagion, where there's a revolution in one place, it becomes more likely in a neighboring or similar country. And we saw this in 89. We saw this in the Arab Spring. We saw this with the colored revolutions. But how does this really happen? And why does this really happen? And are the conditions present in Russia for this to happen at all? And if they're not, why are we even talking about this in the podcast? But anyway, like, what do you guys think about that? Because I don't know what I think about it. I was trying to poke it around myself in my own head this morning. Sean?
It's a really good question. The question of how contagion enacts the street and how revolutions spread from one place to another on the street is a question that, you know, is a big historical question that I don't know if I really have an answer to, outside of political people take inspiration from an event that's happening somewhere else.
That's happening in Russia.
And yeah, they take and they adapt that inspiration to some sort of form of organization.
Okay, so they're one for two.
Yeah, so, right. And then that might tap into already, you know, discontent with the government that is present.
Right, and then the discontent spreads. So you basically laid out a three-stage process here. Russia's on stage one of that three-stage process. That's good. I like that.
But the other side, though, is the reaction of the government, which I think is really key here. And the reaction of we saw what Russia did after the Orange Revolution.
Right.
Where it did a bunch of different interesting measures to kind of combat contagion. Right.
Right.
It
was all about Surkov's sovereign democracy was born. Right?
All of this stuff after 2004 was about preventing infection.
Right.
Right. And they spoke in the language of infection.
Yeah.
And to some extent, what we saw with the media coverage in Russia of events in Kiev and Ukraine in general, it was also a similar language of infection, like mm-hmm. this kind of penetration of Nazi forces, penetration of the West. So the big question for me is actually less how the street is going to react, but more how the government is going to react, because it could create a situation in which the government kind of freaks out and goes overboard,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? And this, of course, could enact processes that might galvanize the streets.
Yeah, and if you go back to 2004 and after the Orange Revolution, I have to say that was very effective. The way they
it was.
It was very effective from the propaganda and information campaign to the whole kind of fake political parties and sovereign democracy and everything. It worked. This was Surkov's creation, and it worked. You have to wonder.
Different, but may I jump in?
Yeah,
They were dancing with a different partner.
Yeah.
You know, now you have a Russian opposition that has the experience of 2011, 2012.
Right.
So the same mechanisms that I'm not saying that you're saying that they would use the same mechanisms.
No.
But the same mechanism. This kind of stuff won't work the second time.
And I don't think they're deft enough to pull this off this time. I mean, this was what Surkov excelled at. But once you do that, once you create this whole fake world, you can only do it once, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes. It's like the Who song. We won't get fooled again, right?
Right.
Mark, anything you want to add or to,
I mean, it's interesting that you have to realize, well, what do people sort of draw their inspiration from? I mean, it's actually about perceptions. And in that respect, I think it's interesting the relentless drumbeat that you find in Russian official media about how miserable Ukraine is now. That basically, you know, neo-fascists have burnt down half of Kiev, and, you know, the Crimeans are desperate to rejoin Russia. I mean, in a way, there is a clear element to actually want to say, heaven's sake, this is a sort of a script from Mad Max movie rather than some kind of great geopolitical example that you would want to follow. But I just want to throw in one extra element to Sean's sort of typology of how these things do. There's also actually about how the contagion affects the elite, not in terms of national policy, shall I say, but in terms of the cohesion of the elite and what they see as their best interests. And again, in that respect, it remains to be seen quite what happens in Ukraine. If actually, you know, we do see the existing corrupt and dirty elite finding themselves, you know, punished dramatically, then actually that might well, I mean, it might play out that it becomes sort of elements within the Russian elite think, well, we need to mend our ways. More likely, though, it actually drives the elite back closer together. Because they think, dear God, if anything happens like that, we're all going to be out. So mm-hmm. even if we have problems with the current status quo, it's better than having a Ukraine scenario. So again, I mean, I think it's not just how the sort of the mass population and the political opposition respond. It's also actually how the elite as individuals and groups respond.
Right. And all this is developing literally as we speak. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the second battle the Kremlin is fighting over Ukraine. The one in Ukraine itself. Is it just saber-rattling or something more? I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russia and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
некоторые наши иностранные партнеры, западные партнеры, считают иначе. Они считают, что...
Some of our foreign partners, Western partners, think otherwise. They consider these authorities legitimate. I don't know which constitution and what legislation they are reading from. I think it is an aberration of consciousness of some kind to give legitimacy to something that in essence is a result of an armed revolt.
I usually don't pay much attention to what Dmitry Medvedev says these days, at least I haven't for a couple of years. But when he called Ukraine's new government illegitimate, I did sit up and take notice, not just because of the strong language coming from a prime minister, but because somebody obviously told him to say that. It obviously reflects the party line. Obviously, given this week's events, the Moscow, you know, pro-Moscow gunmen seizing government buildings in Crimea, seizing airports today, the Russian military exercises near Ukraine's border, the granting protection, as it were, to Viktor Yanukovych, who popped up in Rostov-na-Don today and was giving a press conference just as I was entering this studio and saw a little bit of. Face-saving, saber-rattling, a little of both, or does Moscow have a plan? Mark, you had a pretty tight blog post last week about Russia's options in post-Maidan Ukraine. Any thoughts now after we've seen a little bit of what they've done so far? Where do you think they're going?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I sort of laid out in that post, you know, four options: military intervention, economic pressure, pushing for political regionalization within Ukraine itself, or just simply being a jolly good neighbor and making friends for the long term.
I think that last one was a joke.
it was just, I think it's important to sort of note the alternatives. But alas, I think we can safely rule that one out at the moment. I think, again, I mean, I don't believe that at the moment Moscow has a strategy. I think it has tactics. And in part, I think the key problem is Moscow's not quite sure what it wants. I mean, in a way, There are different potential strands. I mean, there is actually trying to reverse what happened in Kiev. Well, that, I think,
unlikely.
You know, it's clearly, I think that's off the table. I mean, I think they are realistic enough to understand that.
And that was evident in Yanukovych's press conference today. I expected at least some Russian official to be there with him. I expected something a little bit more dramatic than what he said, which he didn't say anything that, I mean, I'm glad I'm not writing the news story on this. I would have been wondering what the hell the lead is. But yeah, that much became obvious.
Well, I mean, just on that, I mean, I would say one thing that I noted that I did think was quite interesting was actually him very explicitly saying that he didn't think that military action of any kind should be employed in Crimea, which, again, one can read in different ways. But it certainly is less than saying I'm appealing to our Russian cousins to come and help us.
Right. Right.
So that at least that potential route, because anyway, I mean, one can make the case that he is still president.
Well, he did make the case, though. It rang kind of silly.
let's be clear. I mean, the vote that was held in Parliament was 10 votes short of the number it really needed. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, you know, one can parse this different ways, and in no way would I consider Yanukovych to be a sort of the rightful president. But, you know, if you really wanted to make that case, you could have said he's still the legitimate president, and he has, therefore, the right to invite us in. Kind of almost an Afghan scenario. Right. Going back to 79. So at least
we know
that seems to be off the table. Well, yeah, but then again, you know, not everyone seems to learn these lessons. You don't invade Afghanistan, and maybe you don't roll into the Crimea too. But I mean, I think, you know, what we've seen is at the moment it's very much, I think, a question of turning to the quick instruments. I mean, economic pressure is not something that is quick. Plus, also, it has massive economic as well as political costs, because it scares the Europeans, angers the Europeans, and it means you lose money, because if you're not pumping gas, you're not selling gas and oil, you're not making money on that. So, you know, again, the Russians have turned to the instruments that they've got at their disposal, which is military force, and again, the ability to create theater around that. The question is, though, that, you know, beyond, if they really want to basically create a Crimean protectorate, that's possible.
Easy.
Anything more than that, that's easy. But anything more than that is actually very, very hard, I would suggest, by military use, you know, sort of means. And even, frankly, taking Crimea, you know, that would not be a comfortable hold, because there's a lot of Ukrainians, there's a lot of Tatars. Exactly. You know, I mean, so I think either way, I'm still, and maybe I'm just being naively optimistic, because after all, that is always my way.
Wait, that's my role.
At the moment, I'm still not seeing real signs that Russia plans any kind of serious military action. I think it's still at that point of just basically sort of waving the tanks around and hoping that that'll cow the Ukrainians.
What do you think they're doing in Crimea, though? What are they doing? Are they trying to create another, a frozen conflict like Abkhazia that they can basically recognize? What's the end game here in Crimea?
Well, I had to guess. I would say that, in a way, what they're trying to make is Crimea look so indigestible to Kiev that they are willing,
just
for their
to
own
say,
reasons,
go.
Say go, or at least to accept this notion that basically the future Ukraine ought to be much more regionalized, federalized, which more or less means that Russia will retain chunks of Ukraine in which the local elites are beholden to Moscow and will basically therefore be Moscow's allies and fifth columnists within the system. Just simply by saying, look, you know, more or less making it clear to Kiev that it will have a real struggle on its hands if it wants to take over the Crimea.
Now, you can do that in Crimea, but as we looked at this week, and one of the things we did here at RFRL this week was take a look at some of the so-called Russian-speaking East, right? And where, if you look at the overall numbers, the top-line numbers, the East is overwhelmingly Russian-speaking. But that's deceptive, because the cities, the big cities, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kharkiv, they're Russian-speaking. The villages all around them and in between them are Ukrainian-speaking by far and away. And as some experts have pointed out, even among the Russian speakers, there are those who want to speak Russian, sympathize with Russian culture, but are loyal to Ukrainian statehood, Ukrainian nationhood, and so on, and sympathize with the Maidan. So I'm not sure they can do what they're doing in Crimea in the East, right? Go ahead,
no.
Sean.
No, I don't think there's any kind of threat of the eastern regions breaking off and going with Russia. I mean, I don't see any indication of that. Many of the reasons you just put forward, we don't see – there's no real separatist movement. The Crimea has one, but it's really, really small. And this is what I think one of the things – if trying to understand what the Russians are doing, I think they are doing a lot of saber-rattling. I would agree with Mark that they don't really seem to have a strategy. They seem to be looking at how things are going to play out. And I really wonder, once the West comes up with its bailout for Ukraine, how they'll react to that as well. Because that one carrot that Russia had, the $15 billion, is no longer operable for them. But in Crimea, you do have this small separatist movement. And I wonder if Russian actions are in some ways trying to embolden or inflame that. Now, the only thing about this is that for Russia to take Crimea on as a protectorate is quite
– Or to incorporate it into the Russian Federation.
Or to incorporate it is not actually a great idea, for the simple fact that there was a joke going around on Twitter earlier that Russia is fighting for the right to subsidize 66% of the Crimean budget.
Right.
So it's a very poor region economically, though I did see some indication that it's receiving a lot of investment.
Yeah,
but
it is one of the most heavily subsidized regions from Kiev.
It is one of it is one of the heavily subsidized. It's a poor region, and so the question is, well, does Russia really? They may kind of step into events that might push them to kind of take this region, but the question is, do they really, really want it? This I don't know.
Yeah, and one has to wonder if the Ukrainian government might just say go.
Because
it would really go, and then there is just one less thing Russia can use. And like I said before, using this strategy in the East is in Donbass or wherever is going to be hard. It's going to be much harder because that's a whole different kettle of fish there. Another thing on this language issue, and this kind of got my attention this week. We did a story on it. I thought it was a really good thing to do. In Lviv, they spoke Russian for a day this week to show solidarity with the Russian speakers in the East and to say that we don't want these new authorities to start playing language games. Because one of the first things the parliament did was took away the right of Russian to be an official language at the local level. And I mean, I lived in Odessa for almost a year. And I'll tell you, in Russophone Ukraine, this is what they care about. I think if you took that issue off the table and you did go ahead and recognize the Russian language, I think you'd have a lot of political allies to taking Ukraine west. I really do. I think as long as that. So it was very interesting to see in Lviv, which is the most Ukrainian speaking of Ukrainian speaking cities. In fact, when I was in Lviv, the only Russian I heard was the bad Russian coming out of my own mouth. But for that city to speak Russian for a day was an amazing gesture. I saw something on Twitter yesterday that Donetsk was going to reciprocate and speak Ukrainian for a day, but I don't know that there's many people in Donetsk that can. I don't know if that ever happened.
May I add something about Crimea? One of the things I did read that might be a problem for the region is the collapse of the Party of Regions power vertical.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if this is going to affect – how this is going to affect the eastern part of the country as a whole, since that's the strongest political party, and how this revolution is going to create a vacuum. And some of my friends have been pointing out the fact that in some of the regions, the vacuum has been taken over by kind of civic organization. And I wonder if this kind of upsurge of kind of separatist activity might be in a way attempt to fill that vacuum of the collapse of the Party of Regions.
That's possible. I read today where the Party of Regions is going to have its Congress on March 6th, but it's not going to have it in Kyiv because it's afraid it's not going to be allowed to, which I thought was kind of weird. I think they'd probably allow them to have their conference on March 6th in Kyiv if they wanted to. Mark, is there a power vacuum looming here, and maybe can Russia step in to fill it in places like Crimea, for example?
Well, I mean, look, the Party of Regions was is basically the party of power, as we've seen elsewhere. I mean, I think in many cases, the sorts of opportunists who joined, and I'm sure there are also some who weren't, but, you know, in the main, if you look at who joined, and the very fact that the Party of Regions so quickly turned and decided to call Yanukovych a traitor and everything else, I mean, you know, they were rats who were trying to stay on the floating ship. In that respect, I think one could quite quickly reconstitute some mm-hmm. kind of political structure. I don't think that's an issue. But I think what it really comes down to is, you know, the question that maybe it's worth dwelling on for a moment is actually, what does Russia want? What does Russia really need? I mean, let's face it, Ukraine for Russia has a clearly sort of a symbolic importance. You know, it is part of its almost sort of Slavic patrimony. And you know, it's a big chunk of post-Soviet Eurasia and such like. So I mean, you know, there are issues of self-image and the perception of how, you know, whether or not Putin wants to be regarded as the czar who lost Ukraine or whatever. But in practical terms, I mean, look, even if there's a shift westwards, what that actually means for the foreseeable future is that it's the European Union that gets to subsidize Ukraine rather than Russia. Or to put it yet another way, it's European euros paying for Russian gas. Mm. That's not necessarily a bad thing. There's no real question of Ukraine becoming a NATO member, especially not so long as there's the Black Sea Fleet in the Crimea, and they have a long-term agreement there. The economy, well, you know, Russia is still going to be able to trade with Ukraine. Russian businesses are unlikely to be being forced out, and therefore the use of Ukraine, if anything, as a sort of a turntable for Russian money into Europe and other constituencies, will, if anything, be easier Ukraine does that. You know, it's not going to get suddenly cleansed overnight. I mean, the interesting thing is that for so many ways, this is a classic case in which actually perception, sort of subjective Russian interests are very much at odds with what I would suggest are objective Russian interests.
With one caveat, and Mark, you yourself pointed this out in this podcast about a month or so ago, but that Ukraine has been a important pre-wash destination for dirty Russian money before it goes farther west or to farther points abroad. This was a very important kind of chunk of the economic model, and that, you know, as Putin tried to expand Putinism to the former Soviet space, which is what the customs union, the Eurasia Union, is all about, you take Ukraine out of that that picture. And it doesn't really, I mean, what are they going to wash their money in Belarus before it goes to Europe? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, but you think, how long has Latvia been a member of the European Union?
Yeah.
And only now is it beginning to get a handle on that. And let's be honest, I think Ukraine would, you know, it's going to be a lot harder to do so in Ukraine than it is in Latvia. So, I mean, again, I think these are very long-term issues.
Yeah.
To be honest, but by the time Ukraine starts getting its act in order, you might well have a very different regime in place in Russia.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I'm also reminded of a conversation I had back in the 90s with Yeltsin's representative in St. Petersburg. We were discussing the breakup of the Soviet Union and why the decision was made and how it was. And he said the decisive moment was when Ukraine declared independence. And I said, why? And his answer in Russian said it all. He's like, Kakoy Soyuz bez Ukraine? You know, what kind of a union can we have without Ukraine? You know, which does say where you're saying this subjective reality overtakes the objective. I'm not sure I'd underestimate this, the importance of Ukraine as the pre-wash destination, though. When you said that, if you remember correctly, I wrote a whole blog post around it because I thought it was pretty damn interesting.
It's exceedingly important. But again, I think what it is that just so far, at least, there's been no signs that the kind of regime that's going to emerge in Ukraine is going to be that kind of root and branch, even if it means in the short term extra economic woes, we're going to do this. You know, Tymoshenko is currently the sort of, you know, the front runner, as it were. I would not regard her as a cleansing agent in many ways.
No, but Klitschko might be. Klitschko might be. I don't think
so
Tymoshenko is. Go ahead, Sean.
Oh, yeah. Russia will kind of continue these kind of symbolic gestures of saber rattling and whatnot, but they might just wait. And it's interesting that the referendum for Crimea is on the same day as the presidential election. So they might wait to see what kind of government is really going to be hammered out here
right. And
for the long term before they actually engage in any actions. Because in all intents and purposes, the actual economics kind of structures of Ukraine, the oligarchy, what they're going to do about corruption, these are big issues that they might not tackle.
And there's a lot of things that are on the play. I mean, not just presidential parliamentary elections, constitutional reform. There's all sorts of things going on. It's interesting who wants to be the president, who wants to be the prime minister, because it's not clear which one's going to be the main post yet. Because you might, if you revert back to the 2004 constitution, I think it's interesting that Klitschko's name was not among those in the government. My assumption is he wants to run for president.
And no matter what happens, the Russian magnetism on Ukraine is just too strong for it to really kind of, you know, cut any kind of real ties from it. It will always have to deal with Russia, no matter what it does, just by the fact that the eastern part of the country is its main economic output.
Yeah.
And a lot of that output goes to the east.
Look, Russia's still doing a lot of business in Georgia right now. I talked to any Georgian official, and they said the volume of Russian business in Georgia is still, given how much Georgia supposedly cut its ties with Russia. Before we wrap up, I want to throw one just a simple little question out here. How is Russia doing? So in the war at home and the war abroad, the two fronts, how is Russia doing on each front, would you say? How successful are they in each front? If you had to sum it up.
Well, if I had to give it, I would say that it's short-term successful, but in the long term, the tide is running against it.
On both fronts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sean, would you agree?
I think I would probably agree with that. I think there's more. I would add to that, there seems to be more disarray rather than any kind of set policy or plan. And that also goes for the so-called war at home. Just arresting a bunch of people is more kind of a flailing reaction than any kind of set kind of strategy.
Yeah, no, the first decisive thing I saw was house arrest for Navalny. That's the first thing that I think departed a little from the set pieces that Mark was describing at the outset of the podcast. Well, that just about wraps us up. That's about all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And I would also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfer.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.